Jordan, Ugly Beauties, Pugs and Crows with Tony Wilson, Barr Phillips, Fred Van Hove and Lou Grassi, and many more. On Saturday, September 7th, check out Jazz at Market Square, a free music village in downtown Guelph on Carden Street. Experience the Guelph Jazz Festival. For tickets, accessibility information, and more, visit GuelphJazzFestival.com.
Hey, how you doing? My radio name is Mac D, and I've been hanging around CFRU for a long, long time. Because it's fun. I started off working the equipment, producing shows, and then moved into doing my own show. Along the way, I've learned about local artists and their music, and other artists and music I never would have heard of or listened to before. I'm still here, still doing shows, still having fun. If what I do sounds like something you'd enjoy, visit us on the second floor of the University Center and find out what CFRU has to offer you.
Hi, I'm Dan Evans, and I volunteer at CFRU because it introduces me to amazing new ideas, and they're usually housed in amazing new people.
Hi, my name is Mina, and I volunteer on CFRU because I get to tell people about things that are going on in Canada that people wouldn't normally hear about.
My name is Kyle, and I volunteer at CFRU to connect with a wonderful group of diverse people.
If you would like to get involved with CFRU, contact Christopher at 519-824-4120, extension 58341, or volunteer at cfru.ca.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Sex. I flex up my bowling for T-Rex, and I learn my art lessons, a jar of checks. I get vexed on an MC rejects. The redness of my rap, which is complex. I got a rep for words which are head wrecks, cause they can't understand the context of my index. I slip into a mode which is big steps, have to rock a rhyme which is in depth. Walk the city streets which are windswept, protect with a knife where the lives get lives kept. Busting loose with my rhyme cause I can't be kept. Back from the fore where I'll dissect and intercept the propaganda that we elect. Clarify the claims of my dialect. You say you're a liberal, I say what the heck, redistribution. You say where's my check, but check yourself. Guy, guess is what you get, reap what you sow. Then I bet your friend not to get you down is one thing I wouldn't let, but to make you wise. So you can reject the system, not a complex. It just infects the minds of the young, like a simplex, simplex.
We got the words to be heard, so listen up here. Always lead from the front, never from the rear. Don't talk revolution from my armchair. All I stand up for, also give a big cheer for the crew which I'm in, whom my life fears.
If I say I want peace, then you say, well, you should put down your gun. But hasn't it occurred to you by now, after 400 years of being brutalized and murdered and lynched and maimed by guns and force on the part of racists and the racist power structure in this country, it's damn near time we picked up the gun to try to begin to get some peace, to defend ourselves and our community from racist attacks by the pigs, to defend ourselves against racist attacks by Birchites or Minutemen or Ku Klux Klansmen or what have you? Hasn't it occurred to you that it's damn near time we organize ourselves in some fashion to have some ability to begin to make racist and the racist power structure act in a desired manner as we define the functional definition of what power is? The ability to define the situation, and we have been defining it. Now we must organize in our black communities to also make the power structure and the racist system act in a desired manner. And what is that desired manner? Politics. What is politics? What is politics? You think politics starts with a seat in the assembly? No, it doesn't. It's related to it, but it doesn't start there. Politics starts with a hungry stomach. Politics starts with a pig crushing us across our skull and murdering our people. Politics starts with the fact that we get a rotten education, we get brainwashed and fooled and a trick notion and trick knowledge and everything else that goes on with us in terms of the exploitation that goes down. Politics starts with the fact that we want decent housing, fit for shelter of human beings. Now this is where politics starts. And black people now understand with the Black Panther Party that we are going to relate to politics in a real fashion. We are not going for no more jive verbal sincerity at all. Don't give me, Robert F. Kennedy, your jive shuck. I think it is necessary here that we come forth. I don't want to hear it. I'm tired of my black brother being brainwashed too. Kingfish, what did you think about John F. Kennedy? Robert Kennedy? Well, Andy, you know how it go there, boy. I think the boy is going to do something there. Look, we're not going for that thing anymore. Robert F. Kennedy was well related to Robert Williams being put in a situation where he had to vamp from this country and split because he was being prosecuted by Robert F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy did not send troops into Birmingham in 1963 until black people decided it was necessary for them to defend themselves. When Martin Luther King's motel was bombed and the races had been attacking us constantly in that particular area and all over this country, why didn't John F. Kennedy send some troops in then? He didn't send troops in until after black people decided we're going to defend ourselves from racist attacks and went to the streets and whooped up a few racist heads. Then John F. Kennedy decided to send in troops. See, all that verbal sincerity, we learn from the past. We learn. So we're going to guide our feet by the lamps of the past. And we're going to make sure that we won't fall into more bags. So peace and freedom, if you want to do something, get down to nitty gritty and don't miss no nits or grits. No more shucking and no more jiving with the McCarthys, with the Lynch and Baines Johnson, with the Governor Regans, with the Robert F. Kennedys, right on down the line. No more shucking and jiving.
Hello, everyone. This is Back in USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried. And that, of course, was Bobby Seale of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, speaking in the 1960s. About black liberation, and a subject that could not be more relevant in today's world, in the context of today's America, in the United States today. Because even though there is a black man sitting in the White House, we see again and again how the power structure in the United States beats down African Americans. And of course, one of the things I said I was going to talk about last week, and I'm going to talk about it pretty extensively here tonight, was of course the example of Ferguson, Missouri. It's a suburb, of course, of St. Louis. And it's been in the news recently because the people of Ferguson have been standing up against police brutality in a very, very blatant, very open and very, very brave and courageous fashion. They've been taking a stand. And effectively, they forced the national media in the United States to actually pay attention. Albeit in a very condescending, very racist, very, you know, misrepresenting way. But they've paid attention to what was going on, what has been going on for years in this African-American community, mostly African-American suburb of St. Louis that has a long history of police brutality, as do African-American communities around the United States in general. And, of course, what happened in Ferguson, Missouri? Well, an unarmed black man, and this is a tragically common refrain we have heard year after year, a unarmed black man was shot dead by the police. And we see the police getting away scot-free for this. You know, there's no there will be an investigation into the Ferguson incident. Who knows how that will turn out. In most cases, this stuff does not even make the news. It doesn't even, like, appear on the headlines. It doesn't get attention, doesn't get investigated, nothing. It's an everyday thing. But in this case, because a whole community rose up, now attention is being paid to this. And I think it's worth noting that the example of Ferguson really highlights that imperialism, as we know from the example of settler colonialism in Canada, is not confined to bombings and invasions of other countries and on other continents. It exists all around us, every day, in our social, economic, and political relations. And no recent example reveals this more than what has been happening in Ferguson, Missouri. And of course, as I said before, what happened is in itself nothing new. The killing of an unarmed black man by the agents of the state, by the police. Because as we know, the United States and its empire was built initially from the labor of enslaved Africans and the extermination of indigenous peoples, as well as the taking and settlement of their land. And then, of course, following from this, a racist regime has emerged to privilege people of European descent while keeping those of non-European descent repressed, subordinate, and living in fear, while also serving the class control function of keeping the American working class divided and at war with itself, and keeping the fortunes of the capitalist robber barons in that country intact. You know, that's what's really going on here. So the killing of Michael Brown by police officer Warren Davis in Ferguson, Missouri, you know, a suburb of St. Louis, last month, is part of a pattern of racial repression deliberately created by ruling class interests going back all the way to the 17th century. When, and this is very, very important, when the white race, the concept of the white race was first invented to stop European indentured servants, who in effect were little more than slaves, from joining hands with African slaves in rebellion against the colonial elite, which they had been doing on numerous occasions. And since that time, since the 17th century, race has been one of the main weapons in the arsenal of the American capitalist class. Whether it was lynch mob rule and Jim Crow terror in the South, to racial prejudice within labor unions, or KKK repression of workers' strikes, police repression of African-American demonstrations, or the so-called war on drugs, whose sole purpose seems to be to lock up millions of African-Americans on the basis of nonviolent narcotics charges in order to serve the bottom line of the private prison industrial complex that is, you know, just burgeoning in the United States right now. The American capitalist state has benefited again and again from a centuries-old divide-and-conquer stratagem that has become ingrained in that country's national psyche and in popular culture. You know, racism has become embedded in American culture. It's there. You know, to the extent that a lot of people don't even know, don't even recognize it. Now, Michael Brown's shooting, getting back to Ferguson, Michael Brown's shooting is one of thousands of similar incidents that happen every year in the United States where the servants of the state, the police, have targeted black people with potentially lethal violence. With that, shootings, beatings, or what have you, illegal chokeholds. But in this case, in this particular case, just like the case of Rodney King in the 1990s, it led to the revolt of an entire community that had suffered through this before too many times and had had enough. So even when Ferguson, the inhabitants of Ferguson, when they demonstrated and they were confronted with riot police, rubber bullets, tear gas, sound cannons, canine units, the National Guard, and even constant calls by the Comprador black intelligentsia and clergy, including people like Al Sharpton or even Barack Obama himself, telling them to stop protesting and stop, quote unquote, being angry. The people of Ferguson still came out in the streets. They still demonstrated and still fought for the control over their own community and over their own lives. And even forcing the government, as I mentioned before, forcing the government to mount investigations and at least make some gesture of caring for black life in America. But in the end, and this is the important thing, in the end, the evil racist system was exposed for what it is. What it really was. And this is on national TV. You know, everyone became aware of what happened in this community. The kind of brutality, the kind of repression, the kind of crackdown, you know, the mass arrests, everything. You know, it became a focus of national attention. And this is despite the best efforts of the mainstream networks like CNN and Fox to conceal and to downplay it or to misrepresent it. I know, of course, just like there was in the case of Hurricane Katrina in 2006, the mainstream media was all focused on, apparently there were some instances of looting. And that's all they focused on. That's all they wanted to talk about. They just wanted to talk about that sort of thing and totally mischaracterize what was going on and not talk about the actual demonstrations, the substance of what was happening in Ferguson. They tried to sidestep it, as they've done many times before. So, though their own town was overrun and crawling with police and soldiers, you know, Ferguson, on the testimony of a few investigative journalists, had practically been turned into an army camp or a military base. And even though mass arrests and brutality were routine during the crackdown on the demonstrations there, the community did not back down and refused to be bribed into silence. Because just like the people of Gaza, just like the Palestinian people, you know, this is, I talked about this last week, the people of Ferguson realized that anger and resistance and the threat of violence is the only language that imperialism understands. Anything else means submission in this context. People have to defend themselves against the capitalist state. People have to defend themselves against imperialism. They can't just turn the other cheek. Palestinians know that. African Americans know that. It's only through the fury of the people that any victories at all can be won in the face of the repressive power of the capitalist state. So like the Palestinians, the African American knows what it means to fight. You know, and as Huey P. Newton of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense recognized decades ago, the swelling numbers of proletarians in the ghettos of America, especially now in the aftermath of this economic crisis, they are more ready for revolution than sometimes even the most radical political parties are willing to admit. And that's something that's very, very important for us to understand right now.
How you gonna do this, son? That's 160 balls, man, no punches. Well, y'all ain't ready for this. Let me talk about some things I hear that many people won't appreciate, alright?
I was raised in streets so cold where hopes rose, where little kids walk around with no clothes, and not because they have no homes, but this is how they were shown, how to live too fast and act too grown, where most live so high yet only know lows, never learn how to stand on their own cause they always face life on their toes, when this concrete jungle with all of its woes, that roses in Harlem that somehow still grow, and I suppose with more tilling their flowers will show, nurture the children and the wind will blow, and the world would be a better place instead of the cheddar race. Or if not a threat to humanity we will forever face. Cause round my block the youth are used as modern day pawns, hustling death till there's nothing left from dusk to dawn. Till every last bit of their soul is gone, and they forever travel in shadows to live life amongst the scorn, wishing they could be reborn, looking for a jack to feed on, and some of them mentally be gone. And since they never got their read on, they never understood why it was important for them to see their seed born. So the next generation grieves on and bleeds on, and this can happen for eons unless we form a legion to attack these demons. I wanna stop our breathing so we can't inhale freedom. How many of our kids have asthma due to the plaster? How many of our family members suffer from cancer? Still look at this government for answers. How many of our youth go bananas at the color of bandanas? Cause their minds have been desensitized by the time they finish failing grandma. Live most of their lives failing grandma or in the slammer, trying to make runs from the slums of New York to Atlanta. Didn't know the difference between a Black Panther and a white panda. Both were extinct animals if you asked them. But if you couldn't mask them and examine and show them all the horror in their lives, they observed the curve random was due to years of steady planning. Our people have been left stranded and abandoned, trapped in way before Katrina ever happened. It's my greater passion that might move them into action, to take their freedom of their people without asking, without vote casting. Cause that hasn't ever had an effect on those who haven't. The have-nots who never had it, never could get it. Raised to be addicts, I wish the whole hood would shed it. Crackers embedded so far in our neighborhoods, community boards are segmented. Most people we thought represented us were demented, looking at 401k pensions instead of where these land grabbers were headed. Just get a big prevented buildings which are rented. Now you need a mortgage for the poor kids, the playgrounds are now fenced in. So you can see how the young tots damaged from a life of untold knocks. Run away from homes with no pops and hand-me-down jeans or old socks. Away from their mom that pops. They can clearly see the traction on arms will only lead to a cold box. And this is why they run non-stop, especially from cold cops. And blocks that have been co-op, but there's no odds since pelt was cropped. Went into a cypher of no-knots at road pot and whole blocks. But the dough got them in dirty below, pushing snow like they drove bots. To be sent up, stained and smothered where the post locked. And this is to the youth that everyone forgot. But my purpose is to convince you, the lyrical use at its pinnacle. To show you how the system can make you utterly cynical. How you tired from a mental umbilical, why you're skeptical about your freedom even being perceptible. Why breaking free is questionable, but freedom is so visible beyond their economic principles. As emancipation can't be divisible by 10, so won't be related to anything you spend. Nothing you can lend, no affiliation to the dollar, euro, yen. Freedom will look like no gem. Couldn't tell you all by the number of inches on your rims. No matter how many pairs of tins or what you wear in your limbs, this is not where freedom begins, but this is exactly where it ends. Cause when I speak of liberation, I'm talking beyond America's upper class imagination, beyond taking long vacations, beyond a house with land the size of the South's largest slave plantation, beyond any payment. Freedom is not some external sensation. It's definitely a test of patience. Some say patience is a virtue, others say it may curse you, but I know hesitant cats in your circle would definitely hurt you. Others may think progress must mirror the moves of a turtle, but I'm sure it's a race ran at its own pace with many a hurdle. And for all movement, the ground's fertile, so I urge you to purge through. The cops already set a curfew. If they catch you after hours, they definitely search you. Might
even murk you. Now I'm rhyming for the fuck it, but I take this personal. This is reality rap, not in virtue. Back to hell, this to nurse you. Give it a Holy Spirit like church you. For those locked in a metaphorical box, this will help you burst through. Cause the project blues, we're just scratching the surface. Now our purpose go to depths like the dollar, show you America's worthless. No matter what you purchase, this downfall is not temporary but permanent. As economists searches for words that won't make investors nervous. Wall Street can't avoid the closing curtains. I'm 100% certain a $1 trillion war is a huge cause for the hurting. Increased rates for Kabul will add to the burden. And 700 military bases for future Vietnam to have lurking. You better off going online, looking to pound conversion. Or run down to the bank urging to buy bonds backed by the Chinese yuan in person. But no matter how many corporate bailouts or stimulus packages, there'll be perpetual crashes, inevitable clashes between the classes. Years of self-serving for supply side earning. Got them printing the mirrors as fast as they can because the dollar's burning. And constructing a super corridor to fortify the North American Union. From Mexico to Canada for international cargo movement. They're fucking shifting humans. As gentrification's a part of a bigger plan of population redistribution. Creating super cities trapped by super highways. And you need a passport to even travel sideways. And if you have questions, I have places to prevent detention. Here there's a misinformation obsession. They're in a depression that can barely save recession. They're playing 1984, them all with their aggression. Orwell to Orwells with their advanced weapons. Now who has pity on a Sunni in Sardar City? See me as a young studious religious boy praying, hoping God is with me. As reality starts to hit me, these American bullets start to rip me. I survived, my sister didn't, so now I'm jihad strictly. Already forgiven, ready to give up living. Deadly with scope precision, blasting at the walls of my hopes in prison. With the hatred of the American fleet that runs really deep. I'ma have a bomb strapped to my chest, but I don't value my life really cheap. This hill I climb is really steep, and only with this IED will the world hear me speak.
Soul, I got to explain to you also your soul, your needs, your political desires and needs, because that is Huey's soul. When we first organized the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, he would say, Bobby, he says, we're going to draw up a basic platform, just basic, that black people can read. He says, we don't want to go real elaborate with all these essays and dissertations and all this stuff, because the brother gonna look at that and he say, man, I ain't got time for that. I gotta go see what I can do for myself. It's just a basic platform that the mothers who struggle hard to raise us, that the fathers who worked hard, that the young brothers in school who come out of school semi-illiterate. You say, we want freedom, we want power to determine the destiny of our black community, full employment for our people. Number three, we want housing fit, decent housing fit for shelter of human beings. Number four, we want all black men to be exempt from military service. Number five, we want decent education for our black people in our community that teaches us the true nature of this decadent racist society, and to teach black people and our young black brothers and sisters their place in society, because if they don't know their place in society and in the world, they can't relate to anything else. Number six, we want an end to the robbery by the white racist businessmen of black people and black people in their community. Number seven, we want an immediate end to police brutality and murder of black people. Because they have not had a fair trial, because they've been tried by all white juries, and that's just like being tried in Germany being a Jew. Number eight, we want black people, number nine, when brought to trial, to be tried by members of their peers. And a peer being one who comes from the same economic, social, religious, historical, and racial background. If the United States government and the courts and the local courts did this, they would have to choose black people from the black community to sit up on the jury. They'd have to choose some of the mothers who've been working 20 years in Miss Ann's kitchen scrubbing floors like my mother done. They have to choose some of them hard-working fathers. They have to choose some of those brothers who stand on the block out there wondering where they're going to get a gig. They're going to have to choose these black people. And number 10, he would say, let's just summarize it. We want housing, we want clothing, we want education, we want justice, and we want peace. This is a basic platform. In case you never knew it or not, of all the things that you've heard in the press, of all the derogatory statements that's been made in the press about Brother Huey P. Newton and I, of all these derogatory statements to guide you away from seeing this basic platform that Huey was talking about for his own people. We have to learn to look through the white press. We have to learn to see what's going on. Now, out of this platform, Huey P. Newton realized that it was necessary for us to start working on these points, these 10 points, practically. Remember number 7? We want an immediate end to police brutality and murder of black people. This is very, very important. And here, whether you know it or not, it's where you start dealing with the black revolution. When Huey says, every black man, put a shotgun in your home. And once we let the man know, say, look, we armed from block to block, and we're going to patrol you from our windows. And we're not going to have you brutalizing none of our people in the streets. Do you realize what kind of power black people have then? Because you begin to neutralize that police force, because them cops going to start riding shaky and scared. In fact, we're in a position then to demand that they withdraw from our community because they occupy our community just like a foreign troop occupies territory. Very important to understand. We hate cops beating black people over their heads and murdering them. That's what we hate. If you got enough energy to sit down and hate a white person just because of the color of his skin, you waste a lot of energy. You better take that same energy and put it in some motion out there and start dealing with those oppressive conditions, and you're going to find out just what you hate and what you're going to stop. To stop racism. You dig it? When you stop racism, you stop brutality and murder of black people by the racist occupying army in our black community. That's what we're going to stop. What's being done to us? You dig it? Can you dig the white power structure and this racist police force and how they've escalated the situation? That before Watts, there was 1,300 cops. Now there's 6,000 cops patrolling black people. That in Oakland, they had 350 cops just 3.5 years ago. Now they got 1,000 cops patrolling black people. San Francisco's double its police force. And every area, major metropolis where black people live all across this country, they've doubled, tripled, and quadrupled their police force, equipped them with tanks, all kinds. We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
You listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM, CFRU. We heard from the welfare poets, has warned them. And, of course, we also heard from Bobby Seale once again. That was the Black Panther Party's 10-point program. And listening to him and talking about, like, the need to stand up to racist police abuse in black communities and, like, and understanding that these police forces essentially are occupying armies within black communities in the United States, you know. And he was talking about this in the 1960s and 1970s. And look at what we're facing today with Ferguson. This is why I wanted to like play some of Bobby Seale's speeches here tonight, because it's so relevant. It's absolutely relevant to what is going on right now in Ferguson and around the United States today. Perhaps it's more relevant now than ever. Maybe it's even more relevant now than it was then. And certainly, you know, the need for self-defense against this kind of abuse has been taken to heart by at least one organization down in Texas. They actually formed the Huey P. Newton Gun Club, which is like a group of African Americans who actually will patrol their community with firearms. And of course, they're named after the founder, co-founder, Huey P. Newton of the Black Panther Party, you know, who was tragically killed in the 1980s. Bobby Seale is still around. You know, they still take inspiration from these guys. You know, what the Black Panther Party did, standing up to the racist power structure, the ruling class in the United States, back in the 1960s and early 1970s. you know, African Americans, they remember that. It's part of their history. It's part of their history of resistance. That's just like the resistance of the Palestinian people against Israeli apartheid is now many, many decades, and of course, in the African American case, it's centuries old. You know, the resistance against slavery, the resistance against Jim Crow, the resistance, the civil rights movement, the struggle for black liberation in the 1960s and beyond. I mean, it's still going on right now. You know, and black people understand that they have to stand up and fight. They have to fight back. They have to, you know, they can't just turn the other cheek, as I said before, and certainly as Bobby Seale said, they can't turn the other cheek. They're faced with an occupying army in their community, and they are doubly exploited in the context of the capitalist system because, you know, not only are they proletarians, they're also racialized proletarians, you know, within a very racist society. So they get doubly exploited on that basis. So they have to protect themselves. And just to illustrate some of what, just how terrifying, just how inhuman some of the repression against black people in American history has been, I want to cite an example that Michael Parenti talks about in his book, Contrary Notions. I'm going to read it here. This is an example from 100 years ago, back in the Jim Crow South. You know, and just what the kind of monstrous, brutal tactics and repression that was unleashed upon African Americans at that time. You know, I'm going to quote from his book. In 1900, Ida Wells Barnett, an African-American woman of no small courage, wrote a vivid exposé of the mob atrocities that were being perpetrated against members of her race in New Orleans. To read her reports today is to peer directly into the ugly and horrific, an ugly and horrific history. The scenes she describes in succinct but telling detail were replicated throughout the South and in some parts of the North. To pick one of many incidents, we read that in 1899 in Maysville, Kentucky, a black man named William Coleman, against whom there was absolutely no evidence of any crime, was slowly roasted to death by an eager crowd. First one foot and then the other, and dragged out of the fire so that the torture might be prolonged. Describing several other autos de fe, these burnings, Wells Barnett remarks with bitter irony that the ordinary procedures of hanging and shooting have been improved upon in the past 10 years. Sometimes thousands of people congregated to witness the burnings. She also provides descriptions of the ordinary lynchings, shootings, and mob beatings. In most of these incidents, the police either proved unable or unwilling to maintain order. Occasionally, they even contributed to the disorder. The hideous descriptions of racist mob madness are enough to make one ask what manner of species are humans that they would inflict such horrors upon other living beings. If Wells Barnett focuses on a central character, it is Robert Charles, an African-American whose only crime was to resist a police beating, flee, and then fight for his life in successive gun battles. Charles was branded a desperado, an arch-fiend, capable of diabolical coolness in his ability to shoot back with deadly accuracy at those who tried to hunt him down. He was repeatedly described as a hardened criminal, even though he had no criminal record and seems never to have committed a crime. Charles made a desperate last stand, single-handedly, in a small building, encircled by a furious armed mob numbering in the thousands. Even as the besiegers set fire to the building, he continued exchanging gunfire with his assailants, killing 5 attackers and seriously wounding 9 others. Finally, Wells Barnett reports, when fire and smoke became too much to endure, Charles appeared in the door, rifle in hand, to charge the countless guns that were drawn upon him. With a courage that was indescribable, he raised his gun to fire again, but this time it failed. For 100 shots riddled his body and he fell dead, face fronting the mob. You know, that's what was going on in New Orleans and places throughout the South 100 years ago during the Jim Crow days. And to some extent, that has not it never really ended. You know, we still see, you know, black people being hunted down and killed, basically just by the agents of the state, by police. And obviously the racist organizations still exist. You know, racism is still endemic in American society. It's endemic in the education system. It's endemic in hiring processes. It's endemic in all the in all forms of society. Studies after study have confirmed this. You know, the fact that racism has not been overcome. We're not seeing a post-racial America. And Barack Obama, in order to be elected president, basically had to conform effectively to the dominant narrative. He couldn't take on the racist power structure. In many cases, his election hinged upon him not challenging that power structure, which is so fundamental to capitalist class, ruling class control over American society. Like I said before, dividing and conquering working people. This is par for the course in the United States. This is what they do. This has been used since the 17th century to turn working people, working class people against one another. You know, to get white Americans, Americans of European descent, basically to be little monsters in the services of the system. They're the ones who are going to go out there and lynch black people. They're going to be the ones who commit atrocious acts against black people, who demonize black people, who are afraid of black people, who think black people are the enemy. You know, these white people, these Americans of European descent, have been trained not to see the ruling class as the enemy, but to seeing this minority of people, this dark-skinned minority of people, seeing them as the enemy. You know, they're the people who they vent their anger against. They've been trained to vent their anger against, to take out their frustrations on, to see as the cause of their problems. You know, and to this day, that ranks as one of the most, probably one of the biggest deceptions in history. The fact that so many people believe those lies, and trained to believe those lies, and still believe those lies. You know, and still see black people is the real enemy and the real threat, as opposed to seeing the ruling class and ruling class power and ruling class exploitation of working people as the real threat to their lives and their livelihoods and their families. You know, it's one of the biggest tricks that's ever been played, you know, in almost in human history, you have to say. So, I mean, that we need to recognize that. You know, the magnitude of the deception that's been going on here. Because only when we recognize that and understand how we, so many people have been duped, tricked, used, and have committed atrocious acts against innocent people, against an entire race, all based on lies. Based on ruling class lies, ruling class attempts to divide and conquer working people. That's really at the heart of the matter. And I think right now it's definitely worth playing a discussion on this matter by Tim Wise, who of course is an anti-racist organizer in the United States, and who has identified this problem. This talks quite a lot about this problem. And when he was here at the University of Guelph a few years ago, he certainly talked quite a bit about it. And that, of course, talks about how white privilege emerged in the first place and how it emerged as an instrument of ruling class control, as a means of turning, of directing the anger of working class and exploited Americans of European descent against effectively powerless minorities, as opposed to against the ruling class that was, of course, exploiting everyone. So I think it's very important that I play that now. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Because if you know the history of the whole concept of whiteness, if you know the history of the whole concept of the white race, where it came from and for what reason, you know that it was a trick. And it's worked brilliantly See, prior to the mid to late 1600s in the colonies of what would become the United States, there was no such thing as the white race. Those of us of European descent did not refer to ourselves by that term really ever before then. In fact, in the old countries of Europe, we had spent most of our time killing each other. We didn't love each other. We weren't one big happy family. The side of my family that comes from Scotland, hell, they didn't even worry about fighting people outside of Scotland. Highlanders and Lowlanders just fought the hell out of each other. So there was no white race, but in the colonies of what would become the United States, what did we see in the 1660s, 1670s? We began to see that Africans of indentured servant status, many of them not enslaved yet, they were not necessarily permanently enslaved. Some were, others were indentured like many poor Europeans for periods of 7 to 11 years. They could work off their indenture and then they would be free labor technically. Realized, as did the white indentured servants, the Europeans who hadn't even been called white yet, that they had a lot of things in common, like the fact that they were all getting their clock cleaned by the elite. And so they would get together more than our history books taught us, to foment rebellion against the elite, to try to get a better deal for themselves on the basis of economic necessity and economic justice. And what did the elite do? When you see that you're outnumbered by black and white folks who are penniless, landless, peasants, you have to do one of two things. You either have to kill them all, but you can't do that because who's going to work? Rich folks weren't going to. They had to get poor people to work. The whole point was to be a person of leisure back in those days. That was the goal, was not to work. So you couldn't kill them all. You didn't want to kill them all. You had to do the work yourself. You had to build your own levee, build your own house. No, pick your own tobacco, harvest your own cotton. No, we're not going to do any of that. So you can't kill them, but you can co-opt them. And so the elite in Virginia, for example, in the colony, begins to give certain carrots to people of European descent, saying things like, you know, we're going to let you own a little land, not much, but just a little. And we're going to get rid of indentured servitude. Now you're free labor. And by the way, once you're free labor, you get 50 acres of land just because you're free labor, see? So we're going to cut you in on this deal. We're going to let you enter into contracts. We're going to let you testify in court. And here's the best of all. We're going to put you on the slave patrol to keep those people in line, right? The idea was you're still going to get your clock clean. We still don't like you. We still aren't going to really empower you or change your economic subordination, but we're going to make you honorary members of this team, and you're going to help us keep those other people down. And so they got a little taste of power, and it did effectively divide and conquer those coalitions. Those rebellions began to stop almost instantly. Fast forward to the Civil War era, you have rich white folks in the South, where I come from, standing up and openly admitting that the reason they're prepared to secede from the Union, and the only reason they ever articulated publicly, ever, was to maintain and extend slavery and white supremacy, not only where it already existed, but into the newly acquired, that is to say, stolen territories from Mexico to the West. That was what they said. Now we lie about it. We say it wasn't about slavery, that it was about states' rights. Yes, the right of the states to keep and maintain slaves, exactly. But back then they had no shame, so they didn't try and cover it up. They openly said it, but once again, the rich didn't want to go do the work. Are you kidding? No. They're going to get poor people to go fight for them. And the poor folks didn't even own slaves. Now think, how do you get poor people who don't even own the shirt on their back, let alone slaves, to go fight to keep your slaves for you? You've got to convince them that their skin is more important than their economic interest. Because think about it, if I am a farmer who has to charge you $1 a day or $2 a week to work on your farm and harvest that tobacco or pick that cotton, but you can get a black person to do it for free because you own them, who's going to get the job? Not me. In other words, slavery actually undermined the wages and the wage base, the economic floor of the typical white working class or low-income person. But they were told, if these people are freed, they're going to take your job. No, fool, they got your job. That's the point. And so at some level, again, working class white people being harmed by white privilege, relatively being advantaged, right? Being given a leg up, being given a membership to the club, but in absolute terms being kept economically subordinated by the very thing that gave them a sense of superiority. How's that for irony? Then in the present era, this hasn't stopped. This is not ancient history. Now we have people running around insisting that we should close the border with Mexico because if we don't, the wages of working class people will continue to fall. The implication being that the only reason workers are paid like crap in this country is because the border is open. But if you believe that, you would actually have to believe that if that border were closed, that all these owners of capital and industry would just say, oh, well, you figured us out. Here, it's a raise. Do we really believe that the only thing keeping bosses from paying people more is the presence of low-wage, medium, semi-skilled labor from south of this artificial border? Is that really what we believe? We know that if that border is closed, it isn't going to be closed to capital. It isn't going to be closed to goods. If you have a border that can be crossed by capital looking for the highest return on investment, or goods looking for the highest price, but labor is chained to its country of origin, how is that going to work to the benefit of working people? By definition, it doesn't. By definition, it immiserates the working class. Divide and conquer. But the best example of all, perhaps, in the contemporary era in the greater New Orleans area after Katrina. Here you have two communities that were the most hard hit. The Lower Ninth Ward, mostly black community, 94% African American, about 40% official poverty rate, heavy working class community. And right across the canal, St. Bernard Parish, Chalmette, 95% white, also working class, high levels of poverty, economically very similar. And at the end of the day, in those first few days of September 2005, more similar than they probably would have realized. Because when those levees broke, they all got their stuff jacked. They all got their stuff destroyed. But if you had asked white folks in Chalmette, and I've done it, who was the cause of the problems in the greater New Orleans area prior to that flooding, they would have pointed across that canal at those black folks, wouldn't have called them black folks, and would have said, there, that's the problem. 70% of the white folks in St. Bernard Parish voted for David Duke, white supremacist, neo-Nazi, former head of the largest Ku Klux Klan group in the United States when he ran for governor in 1991. 7 out of 10 gladly voted for him because he was blaming black folks for all of their problems, and they bought it. What's the irony? The irony is that while they were blaming black people for their problems, while they were blaming black people for the conditions of the greater New Orleans area in which they lived, nobody was paying attention, least of all they, to the fact that these white elite politicians, either in Baton Rouge or in Washington, whose job it was to secure those levees, to make sure that levee funds were spent in the proper way and that they were spent at all, those mostly white and mostly elite politicians did nothing. At the end of the day, it wasn't just the black folks in the Lower Ninth Ward they didn't care about. They really couldn't have given a rat's ass about those poor and working class white folks either. And yet, when the people of Chalmette, people of St. Bernard Parish got back into session, first time they had a city council meeting, parish council meeting after the flooding, the lights aren't even on yet. The water isn't even hooked up. And the first order of business was to pass an ordinance saying that you couldn't rent property in St. Bernard Parish to anyone who wasn't a blood relative. Now, I'll leave it to your imagination as to why you'd want to pass a law. That law had never existed before. But now that it's been emptied out and you don't know who might come back, that's a damn good way to keep black people out, isn't it? Because if you're 95% white to begin with, if you pass an ordinance that says that, that's a great way. You can't say no blacks need apply. You can't say no blacks allowed. But that was an ingenious way to get around the law. Now, they got caught. There was a lawsuit threatened and they got rid of the ordinance. But my point in bringing it up is to say, once again, divide and conquer is working. These white folks in Chalmette need to march across that canal and join hands with the black folks who've been sitting there more than willing to work with them for an awful long time, and march on Baton Rouge and march on D.C. and march on the Corps of Engineers and recognize their commonality of interest. But the whiteness and the lure of whiteness has tricked these have nothing in their bank account white people into believing that they got more in common with the rich white folks on St. Charles Avenue that didn't lose anything in that flooding than they have in common with the black working class folks who live about 500 yards away.
The clock traffic block, the kids coughing black, snot, blood clot, billboard talking nonsense. Apartment get robbed of content. Shit's tense while the rents increase. Minimum wage stays a piece of feces slash treason. I can't breathe easy. Concrete reaching east, west, north, south to connect your house to some tower of some company power. Acid shower. Thousands are born rare deformity. Suburban golf course, four course beasts. City eats it, breathes shit in her condition, leaking in, seeping through the cracks she passed. It's concrete and steel advance.
She's barely breathing.
Against the flesh of the
it's a reason, gas bleed through the steel and the glass saying the city collapses.
In the architecture, the city center set off sensors. This mention of violence and cab drivers ride like theme park. It's only ever dark or sharp as light, like night, life, light. And kids are high as kites, fucking or fighting. Night vulture, more walking, new macho, got a Glock. Heart tarmac, lot reflector, heat off and it makes us nauseous from fumes and toxins. And you can thank the sponsors for making it all possible.
She's barely breathing.
Against the flesh of
it. It's a reason, gas bleed through the steel and the glass saying the city collapses.
Against the flesh of the heathen, heathen, just even against the flesh of the heathen. I can feel the city creeping.
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
What's up? This is Teaspoon from Delhi to Dublin, and you're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
The Eden Mills Writers Festival is gearing up for its 2014 program, which runs September 11th to 15th, both in the city of Guelph and just 10 minutes east in the beautiful village of Eden Mills. Confirmed authors and musicians include Eleanor Catton, Lynn Cody, David Adam Richards, Miriam Taves, Ann Michaels, Heather O'Neill, Terry Fallis, Scott Merritt, Sandro Perry, Sean Michaels, Carl Wilson, and many more. There's also the 100 Story Wood Workshop, which unites Canadian authors and high school students for a day of writing on Monday, September 15th. For more information about the physical accessibility of our venues and to purchase tickets or sign up for workshops, please visit EdenMillsWritersFestival.ca.
Êtes-vous francophone ou francophile?
CFRU is looking for French-speaking volunteers to start or contribute to French-language programming on the station. Le genre du programme est à vous, que ce soit sur les actualités, la justice sociale ou les arts, la meilleure émission sera sur un sujet dont vous êtes passionné. Nous offrons la formation gratuite en technologie et production des médias.
envoyez un message avec votre nom et coordonnées à Brian par courriel à polylingual@commercialcfru.ca pour devenir bénévole dans cette nouvelle radio collective. Apportez votre voix à CFRU 93.3 FM, la radio communautaire de Guelph.